a hill of tombstones from which the owls have flown. The chisel chipping in finds names the wind can't blow away. It breaks the heart that stone holds what time let go, but stones are the time left that names can be in. Nothing, though, not stone nor light, lasts like the place I keep the love of you in, and this, though nothing can write it down, and nothing keep it. This is KCSU Stanford, and I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions, inserting some verses from A.R. Ammon's poem Tombstones into this drum solo, which I'm going to start fading out now. I've never opened a show with a percussion solo before, but today's episode follows the sound of a different drummer, and where we go from here is anybody's guess. I'm joined today by the person who performed that drum solo. His name is Alex Nielsen, a Scottish musician and composer. And without further ado, I'd like to welcome him to the program. Alex Nielsen, thanks for joining us today on Entitled Opinions.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
To tell our listeners a little about you, you're the founding member of the UK band Trembling Bells, which recorded some 6 albums before you went on to make 4 solo albums under the band name Alex Rex. And you're just about to have a live release of a limited edition cassette of 50 called Memory Speak, available exclusively from Rex Bandcamp as of December 10th. You're the songwriter of all the tracks on all of those 10 albums, and that's a lot of songs for one person to write in 10 years, and you're far from done yet. Let me also mention that you and I know each other through Entitled Opinions. You've been listening to us for a few years now, and I've even played one of your songs, A Handful of Hair, on a show I did not too long ago called On Separation. Last year, I agreed to write the liner notes for an Alex Rex album that came out this past summer with the title Paradise. Fast forward a little, I got an email from you over the summer in which you said you really enjoyed my lockdown podcasts reciting Jimi Hendrix and Jethro Tull lyrics, and you wondered whether I would consider reciting some of your lyrics, which you would then apply to abstracted versions of their corresponding songs. I was impressed enough by your lyrics to accept, and during today's show, we're going to hear some samples of that cross-pollination. But first, I'd like to ask you about your craft or sullen art in general. In my liner notes to your new CD, I call Paradise an album of existential folk rock in an Orphic register. I had my reasons for invoking Orpheus. You declare somewhere, and I quote you here, "Songwriters should be like antique poets, setting their bulletins of devotion to the singing body of the lyre only when they are moved by the muses. This is not a lofty privilege, but a basic responsibility." End quote. Now, I have this image of you composing your songs with a lyre or some other stringed instrument, but in fact, the only instrument you actually play is drums. So my first question for you is, do the muses reach you through your drums or by some other means?
Hi, Robert. Well, thanks for that. Yeah, the muses do reach me through my drums. I'm very committed to drumming, and I have been for the last 20 years or so, but I don't really compose via the drums. That largely happens in my head in a kind of Beefheartian, I want this to sound like a butterfly howling at a glass teardrop moon kind of way, like quite an abstract form of composition. But yeah, drumming is quite fundamental to my appreciation of music, and it's quite an intuitive approach. And yeah, it's not a very dignified way to make a living, just kind of hitting surfaces with sticks, but it's served me quite well over the years.
Yeah, fair enough. There's a lot we could say by way of speculation about the relation between percussion and lyricism. I, for one, think that rhythm and cadence are the most important elements of lyrics and of maybe even of poetry in general, but we'll leave that aside here for the moment. Let me ask you about the antique poets you refer to in that statement of yours about the singing body of the lyre. I take it that you mean ancient Greek and Roman poets. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very motivated by, I guess, tragedy, kind of Greek tragedy. I over the years, I guess I've dipped my toe into kind of Aeschylus and Sophocles and these things. And I guess I was particularly interested, maybe in my email correspondence with you, perhaps referring to the poet Sappho and poets of that era that whose poems were intended to be sung, and trying to invest the craft of songwriting with something slightly more kind of poetically engaged as well is kind of interesting to me, and that kind of preponderance for tragedy and fatalistic love, I guess.
That's interesting that you would find the ancient poets more liberating than the freewheeling beat poets who were not bound by any conventional poetic forms, right?
Well, I think as much as anything with poets such as like Ovid and Catullus that I came to, it was almost like an unfulfilled promise of what beat writing was suggested to me, that, you know, the beats had this incredibly kind of like liberated style that was quite, you know, had this kind of internal momentum, which was very compelling. But reading like Ovid, for example, that's almost like the kind of unfulfilled promise of the beats to my mind. It has much more of a liberated, lyrical, self eviscerating kind of quality to it that I find really compelling.
And you say that even despite the fact that you have a kind of free verse in the beat poets that you don't have, where you, in classical poets like Ovid and Catullus, you have, I don't want to call them rigid poetic forms, but they are poetic forms that are much more contained and regulated. And it's not free.
That's perhaps true. Perhaps it has the kind of liberation of, for example, like 12-bar blues or something, where the kind of strictures, when the form becomes kind of warped and elasticated even slightly, perhaps because it does have this template, it seems all the more remarkable and all the more innovative.
And you mentioned the word tragic a few times in tragedy, and I gather that that is something that speaks to you directly among the antique poets and Aeschylus, Sophocles and others, and that there is a great deal of tragic elements to your own lyrics, especially in the more recent years after a personal tragedy that you underwent with the death of your younger brother, sudden death, rather, I would imagine, a shock of a death for you that also coincided with a breakup in a relationship that has left many traces in, you know, the last few albums that you've recorded, right?
Yeah, that's definitely fair to say. I mean, I guess just going back to the tragedians we were referring to, one thing that I found very motivating and creatively compelling about them is the sense that the protagonist built into his kind of unique quality, or, you know, his greatness, if you might call it that, is his own downfall. Like, the very thing that seems to propel him and mark him or her out, to be a remarkable, you know, epochal individual is also written into that as their own destruction. So I often find that like a very compelling idea. And so, yeah, it's kind of giving a poetic voice to to self-defeat is something which I find very interesting. And yeah, I guess, as you just mentioned, in my own personal life, I had this very kind of life-shattering event, which was the sudden death of my younger brother. And, you know, the reverberations of that were just so profound and something that I'm still kind of coming to terms with now and experience in different ways all the time. But as a kind of songwriter, for better or worse, the way that I dealt with it at the time, even on the very day, was to start writing. I guess I'd never experienced anything remotely like that before, and just in order to try to process it at all, make any kind of sense of it, I was writing immediately. And the seed from the seeds of that came some song ideas.
Well, it came a number of albums. I mean, a handful of albums, I would say, you know, in the wake of that.
Yeah.
In the wake.
Yeah,
of
that. I'm actually thinking about bumping off my other brother to for the next album.
Yeah. In classical tragedy, the gods have a lot to do with the self-defeat of the tragic hero. They're always standing by, as you know, to strike down the mortal in his moment of hubris when he overreaches or transgresses a certain limit. Yeah, that's what's interesting about the tragic hero and about human beings in general. Most of us, whether we intend to or not, are always overstepping one limit or another and overreach in one way or another. And maybe that's what human guilt is all about, understood not in the Christian sense, but in this Greek sense, tragic sense of stepping out of bounds and finding that the foundation has given way and that you're kind of suspended over an abyss. And getting back to you now, I find a lot of this kind of primordial guilt coming through in your lyrics, or at least the more recent lyrics of your new album, Paradise, as well as the previous one of yours, Andromeda, where you do a lot of self-interrogation and self-recrimination, and going even so far as articulating moments of self-loathing. It's a real descent into dark corners and recesses of a self that has really been yanked out of its comfort zone.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very kind of honored by those insights. I mean, that's kind of the thing I'm striving towards, or at least when I see other examples of that, you know, cinema, in literature, in just daily life, they're the things that most draw me, that a personality kind of pushed towards crisis point and kind of reporting back from that has always been something that I find particularly motivating, if it's kind of given a poetic voice.
It's motivating, and at the same time, I think that I would have to say that it might be therapeutic. In your case, as you said, that the you know, the tragedy provoked you into a period of intense creativity, of writing, of songwriting. And if you want to invoke here a Freudian distinction between working through and acting out a trauma, I think it's fair to say that you have done a heroic job of working through the trauma rather than acting it out, no?
I mean, I've done my fair share of acting out. Don't be fooled by that. But I have also tried to take responsibility for the emotional fallout of the experiences and, yeah, tried to process them in a meaningful way. And I guess I was in therapy for a couple of years and, just trying to reacclimatize to this new reality of sudden personal tragedy and take some responsibility for my own emotions, as I say. And yeah, and that can be a very painful experience and one that involves a lot of recrimination and self-criticism. Again, I feel as if that's good fuel for writing. And I also attended, I probably shouldn't really be saying this because they're supposed to be anonymous groups, but I attended various kind of, you know, drug and alcohol anonymous groups, and not necessarily because I needed them in a meaningful way, but the tendency towards
catharsis.
Yeah, catharsis and kind of emotional vulnerability and nakedness is something which I just find incredibly valuable, you know, in my life. And to hear other people's testimonies, yeah, we're incredibly inspiring to me. And you know, I guess, as I say, you know, people who've been to the brink and reported back from it is something which I find very ennobling and try to suffuse my own writing with.
Indeed. Well, let's give our listeners a you know, a sense of what your lyrics are like. And I mentioned that you asked me to recite the lyrics to some of the songs and that you kind of reconfigured them, where now it's not a singing voice, it's my own reciting voice. And the first one you sent me of that, I thought it was really very beautifully done, and I circulated it among some friends and family members, and everyone, there was this universal consensus that, you know, this is great. If you did another 7 or 8 of them, that they, you know, a number of people said they would buy that album right away. So we have 3, and yeah. I think that we might have time to go through all 3 of them. I'd like to start with one that is called Master, and after we give it a listen, maybe we can discuss it a little bit.
Shall we?
Master, I know I've fallen short of expectation, but since you rescinded your empire of cruel gestures, it's lonely in the bunker of my skull where I'm writing out this note for you. Master, I know these aren't the things you like to hear, but I really tried my best for you, my master. Taking on your causes as my own, carrying your sandwich boards. Master, my face is pressed against your broken window. I'm a bedsheet ghost in your abandoned ballroom, dancing to your theremin alone. Is that what I came here for? Master, I know these aren't the things you like to hear, but it's really been a horror of a year. My shadow laughs behind my back, Master. Still, my family send their best to you. Alex, when you sent me that song, I and a few other people hearing it for the first time were convinced that it was an address to God somehow, a God in an age after the death of God, if you want, or some kind of weird post-divine God. And then you indicated that it's not exactly what you had in mind, that the word master is inspired, in fact, by Emily Dickinson and her those 3 remarkable, highly enigmatic master letters that she wrote. Is that indeed the case?
Yeah, I was very intrigued by that as a kind of tranche to her biography on reading about her life, you know, her strange kind of enigmatic life. And yeah, I just thought it was an incredibly powerful and evocative address that she referred to this lover, perhaps, as master. And I'd always wanted to adopt that as a songwriting, a way to hang a song around in this kind of epistolary address, almost from an emotional masochist to his remote kind of dominatrix, mm-hmm. emotionally speaking, of course. So yeah, that was the kind of narrative device almost for the song. And then, you know, thank you so much for lending your extraordinary voice to it. It's a great honor for me to hear that. And for you to kind of take it seriously, you know, I guess in many ways it's just been incubated in my own mind. And then, you know, to kind of hear it reflected back at me like this is a great honor. So thank you.
Well, yeah, it's bizarre even for me, because I don't know why there are some lyrics it's very exceptional, but they seem to speak from within a space that is real is the wrong word, but that there's it seems to be in touch with some kind of deep source of the soul, and it can take any forms of expression. But I certainly heard this kind of Orphic descent into some depths of grief and pain and what have you, and the way in which the lyre that accompanies you on that, metaphorically speaking in this case, because it's not the drums, as I said, but that the that it resounds in the hollow body of an instrument that is actually giving us sounds from that underworld into which Orpheus descends. So
yeah, well, so, you nailed it. Again, that's very flattering to hear. I mean, I'm very proud of the song. You know, I feel as if it has this pitch of almost emotional kind of asceticism or something. It has a kind of austerity to it, which I quite like. Yeah, I mean, I'm quite proud of it, as I say.
So the second one I'm going to play it now is called The Uses of Trauma. And here again, I think that the tragedies that we've referred to and alluded to earlier in our conversation come through quite clearly in this track. Began as a joke, quickly turned bitter. I weathered the storm by becoming the weather. No news is no news, no better, no better. I wrote them down on my arm, the uses of trauma. To the mountain, looking for answers. The mountain was weeping. My mother, the mountain, frozen in mourning, shaking in horror, silently mouthing the uses of trauma. A terrible bird with black and gold feathers. Galaxies are his eyes, whirling forever. It all fades to black. Wait here for me, Mother. It's here that I'll sing to you the uses of trauma. I emerge from the mountain, chained to a tiger, famished of love, nourished in anger, drowning in love. That's the way it is, brother. A gaggle of shadows tell tales on each other. But I can't touch the sides, and I can't see the bottom. windows are flaking and cracked with all the things I've forgotten. And the guard dog is laughing. His brain is a spider. He's whispering my name in a frenzy and moving towards me. And I too am laughing, my head in the water, keeping it safe from all the uses of trauma. Shake for me, baby, sing to me, lover. It's the kindness that kills you. Just ask my brother. So shake for me, baby, and cling to me, lover. It's the kindness that kills you. Just ask my... Those are very beautiful background vocals in the uses of trauma there.
Mm-hmm.
Who is it who's singing that?
That's a friend, Jill O'Sullivan, who does music under the name Jill Lorien. She's a very remarkable and beautiful musician here in Glasgow.
Well, my compliments to her. And the lyrics, obviously, again, the uses of trauma, I think it goes back to, you know, what I was saying about trauma being put to some good use, not good use, but the idea that you can turn trauma into art, into poetry, into the music, that there are these uses of trauma. I don't know what you would do without it, actually.
Yeah, well, personal crisis is to me what daffodils were to Wordsworth, yeah, or Cadillacs were to Chuck Berry.
Very good. So is there anything about the uses of trauma that you want to comment on, or should we move on to our next track?
I guess the circumstances under which I wrote it would seem quite immediately come to mind. I think I entered St. Pancras train station in London, and it all just came to me in one kind of organic gush. Like, I think by the time I entered the train station, it started to come to me. And by the time I left, I walked through the other side of the train station, I'd written it.
What do you mean by written it? Do you mean literally you wrote it down, the lyrics, on a piece of paper, or that it was written in your mind, that you heard it in your mind?
I guess a combination of those things. Yeah, I kind of received it all in one go, almost kind of unedited, on entering the train station. It's this, I don't know if you know the building, it's this incredible Gothic revivalist building in central London. At the time, I stayed quite close by there, near the British Library. And the way that the song is kind of intoned almost feels like an abstract kind of diary entry or something. So I think I was, yeah, just trying to kind of evoke that feeling, this kind of diaristic, fragmented, almost kind of splintered, psychological, trying to come to terms with the sudden impact of a traumatic event.
Well, you know, the traditional conventional term for that is inspiration. So you clearly were seized by the gods. That's the older way of thinking about it. Yeah. Or by the nymphs. I've referred in your regard to nympholepsy, you know, the... and I guess we'll leave the nymphs out of it for the moment. Okay? So the last one I'm going to play, Alex, is one that has been recorded but hasn't been released. It's called Bramley Fall Woods. Is it Bramley Fall Woods or Bramley Woods Fall?
Well, Bramley Fall Woods are actually, that's a park area just near where I grew up in Leeds in the north of England. So that's the name of the park, Bramley Fall Woods. And I guess just the kind of juxtaposition of words is quite strange something I always took for granted. And then when I guess my younger brother lived and died on a canal boat in the area of the woods, and worked in a pub there called the Abbey. So yeah, it's just a kind of looking at the event of his life and his death in through different vantage points.
That's very helpful, actually, because I did not know until now that Bramley Fall Woods was near the place where your brother died, because your brother's presence is very intense in this song, for sure, and in the lyrics. Yeah. It's raining azaleas in the heart of the wood. The good look down. The good look down. The good look down. The good look down. With a mouthful of blood. I'm still doing the things that I did at 19, but more doggedly, more desperately, more joylessly, more jealously, more fearfully, clinging to the dream. I carried this damn piano all the way up the street. Then you came along and tinkled fucking autumn leaves. But I miss you most of all, my brother. Especially when Bramley Woods fall. A wand for enchantment, abandonment, deception, depression, creation in its most naked form. I am the greatest artist I've ever fucking met. Got ulcers to prove it, and the great lines laced with regret. 'Cause I miss you most of all, my lover. Especially when Bramley Woods fall. Especially when Bramley Woods fall. Musically, is a very beautiful composition, Alex. So, congratulations on that to you and your fellow musicians, because it sounds like a lot of people, you know, contributed to it. Certainly, the final realization.
Yeah. I really have to give credit to Rory Hay, particularly, who is almost the kind of handmaid into or the kind of midwife to a lot of the ideas that, as I say, kind of come up with in my head, and then he kind of delivers them into the world by interpreting my fairly abstract way of communicating them and makes them into these, you know, sculpts them into these musical creations. So thanks to him.
Yes, well, Rory Hay is, I gather that he's essential to the whole project from many points of view. He's also the one who takes care of a lot of the mixes. I know that he's the one that we owe this remixing of the original music with the recitations now inserted into the
absolutely place. He looks like well, he also has red hair, kind of similar to me, but he's about a foot taller than me, so he kind of seems as if I'm his kind of ventriloquist dummy, and much of our musical relationship and our personal relationship also
well
feels a little bit like that.
Thank you, Rory. We're grateful that he's done this. So we have time, I think, for a track that you brought to my attention, because I did I knew of Baby D, but did not know the album that you drew my attention to, and especially this song where you're playing the drums for on the recording, called "I Am a Stick." And mm-hmm. I'd like our listeners to hear that track. But first, can you tell us something about Baby D, who she was, and what her musical career is all about?
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. And she is one of my great musical heroes. We were fortunate enough to release albums on the same record label, Tin Angel Records. So we kind of connected through that. And yeah, she has this incredibly kind of billowing, romantic style. Her music's quite hard to categorize in many ways. She seems to have emerged on the same kind of underground kind of New York art scene as Anthony and the Johnsons, if that might give some kind of indication as to some of the tone of her music. It has this kind of achingly romantic quality, and her sense of rhythm is very intuitive and very sophisticated, and it feels very simpatico with my own. And I have toured with her like all over the world, often just as a duo, just her and I, and had many, long nights of the soul together, and shared a lot of each other with each other. And she's one of my great friends and great musical heroes.
Right. And I gather you were taken to be her son in a restaurant in Rome. Is that right?
Yeah, we were performing in Rome, and we're both big fans of Italy and the great cuisine there. And we had this incredible meal, and then a fan of hers spotted us in the restaurant and said, bambino, and then bambi bambino, as if I was baby's baby.
Right.
So that was that nickname stuck.
Right. Well, I should mention that Baby D is a transgender woman, because mm-hmm. I think that also helps contextualize the lyrics of the song that I'm going to play. In fact, why don't I read the lyrics in case they're a little bit difficult to understand? I am a stick. In endless streams of play, you heal the wounds of my arising with that softening touch of skin where I leave off and you begin. I am a stick and I am happy, like the bird and like the bee. I always thought you wanted me because I was a tree. But now I know you wanted me because I am a stick. It was nice in the dark, all covered up in bark, and I was sad when they cut me from the tree. But once the cutting was done, they laid me out in the sun. How long am I? I am a stick, and I am happy. In endless streams of play, you heal the wounds of my arising with that softening touch of skin where I leave off and you begin. I am a stick, and I am happy. Alex, it probably bears mentioning before we play the track that Baby D was also a tree surgeon. Is that correct?
Yeah. So she has a deep empathy for the plight of the stick and the tree, I imagine.
Okay, here we go.
like the bird and like the bee. I always thought you wanted me. The catting was done. They laid me out in the sun. How long am I?
I asked you to query Baby D about her musical influences because it's really quite remarkable. I mean, there's so many things going on in that song there in terms of genres and tradition. I mean, you have the cabaret, you have recital, you have the French chanson, a bunch of stuff. And she kindly responded to your query by saying that this album of hers, the I Am a Stick album, because the whole CD there. The album is mostly a sort of road album simply because in the time I wrote it, I was moving to Europe, but the title song is actually a sort of agoraphobic love song. Agoraphobia is a fear of public spaces, I should mention. There's also that happy little murder ballad, Tokyo. I presume that that's Tokyo is on the same album.
That's right, yeah.
You play on that one too, you being Alex Nielsen. Those are my favorites. I've always felt uncomfortable talking about influences, definitely arcane, mostly kind of ancient, but in a scruffy way. Yes, I'm kind of scruffy. It's forms more than persons that influenced me. Parody mass, choral prelude, three voices in counterpoint. What does that mean to anybody apart from making me sound like an obtuse asshole? End of quote. There you get a real sense of the arcane sources of influence. A little bit like yours, mostly ancient, as she says, no?
So yeah, she certainly introduced me to a lot of ancient sources, yeah. I mean, Palestrina comes to mind, like a lot of early musical composers and, ancient poets and biblical references and things like that. She's a great reservoir of knowledge and experience.
Yeah, and it really is a great album, the whole thing. And there's definitely an Anthony and the Johnsons resonance there. There's a kind of attunement between those two musics. Really remarkable stuff. So, we have time just for an outgoing song, which I had a hard time trying to choose which song I would, you know, end our show on, Alex, because you have so many albums and there are so many good candidates. And I really did want to choose one from the most recent CD of Paradise, but I couldn't resist choosing this funeral music for Alex Rex, which is actually a track on your previous album, Andromeda, which is another beautiful album. So I'm going to play that as our outgoing song. If there's anything about it that you want to say beforehand, now would be the time.
Well, I guess something just comes to mind immediately, which is, again, talking about these ancient reference points, and I guess the title of the song, and actually the musical, the chord progression is taken from Henry Purcell's funeral music for Queen Mary, I think it's called. So yeah, it was a kind of a bastardization of that, where I put myself or a kind of creative surrogate, Alex Rex, as the subject. And I guess also the name of the group, Alex Rex, is some kind of reference to Sophocles and a kind of sense of doomed kind of predestiny and this kind of one-eyed tyrannical kind of law, almost a kind of cosmic law that, again, I tried to kind of build into my songwriting and this kind of this worldview, that this primatic worldview through this alter ego.
Right, Alex Rex, alluding to Oedipus Rex, which is the first part of the trilogy of the Oedipus plays. And of course, it probably bears mentioning that that trilogy ends with Oedipus at Colonus, where through all of the suffering and pain and tragedy that the hero has undergone, there is some hint of redemption by virtue of the fact that he is buried outside the city of Athens and that his presence in the underworld outside of Athens will bring blessings to the city in the future. So there's that way in which this kind of soul-shattering descent into the depths of grief and pain have some mysterious promise of a, if not a redemption, some kind of reclamation at the end of the story. So I would imagine something similar applies also to Alex Rex and that Orphic journey of yours.
Yeah, hit it.
I will, and you. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. This is such a honor for me. You know, I mean, talk about inspiration. Listening to Entitled Opinions as often as I do, you know, that's been a great repository of knowledge, and that, you know, that your kind of intellectual curiosity and the scope of that has been incredibly inspiring to me.
Well, thank you. Yeah,
your erudition also. So, thank you so much.
Well, there's a lot of erudition on your end. I have to say, though, that you're a dropout from college, right?
Yeah,
that's a great time.
English and art history for about 20 minutes.
Exactly.
15 years ago.
And here you are, you know, reading all those poets like Catullus and Ovid and so forth. Great stuff. Okay, thanks again for coming on, Alex Nielsen. I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions, and we're going to leave you with a track from Alex Rex's album Andromeda called Funeral Music for Alex Rex.
Groaning deep in the wild, wild wood.